Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Hello, and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are getting up to. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Emily Ferguson, who's doing a PhD in kinesiology under the supervision of Dr. Chris McGlory. Welcome to Grad Chat, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. And before we dive right into the research aspect, could you tell us a little bit about your academic journey up until this point? What brought you to Queen's for your PhD?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I did my undergrad in kinesiology at Wilfrid Laurier University. And there, kind of like I'm assuming many kinesiology students, I was thinking about a career in an allied health profession like physiotherapy. But I got exposed to some research, particularly in the lab of Dr. Tom Hazel. And that really kind of gave me, I kind of caught the research bug a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so I had this kind of interest in muscle disuse, mitochondrial physiology, and kind of more metabolism. And then that kind of brought me to Queen's and the SKHS, where Dr. Chris McGlory had just started as an assistant professor. And it's been really good to learn from him in terms of I was there when he started the lab, and now the lab has grown so much and is doing so many really cool projects. So I did my master's with Chris, or Dr. McGlory, and doing my PhD with Dr. McGlory as well. So it's been an amazing journey.
Oh, very nice. Yeah, it's exciting to be one of the first students in a new environment. So you get to, I mean, I know PIs have obviously lots and lots of knowledge, but it's their first time in a lab. So you get to learn a lot along the way as well about how to set up a strong lab. And it sounds like it is one because you have stayed this long. So
absolutely. And learning how to pivot during the pandemic was something that it's a very unique learning experience.
Yes. So I think wherever you will go next, you will be very flexible after a research career during the pandemic.
Absolutely.
So can you tell us a bit about your research topic? You mentioned a little bit there what got you interested early on in research, but what is your current PhD project?
So my current PhD project is kind of a couple different projects. So one of the projects that I worked on for my PhD was looking at sex-based differences in mitochondrial respiration and mitochondrial content. Mm-hmm. So really the question that we were answering there is when males and females are matched for aerobic fitness, are there differences in rates of mitochondrial respiration and mitochondrial protein content? Overall, we found that when females and males are matched for VO2 peak, so maximal oxygen uptake normalized to fat-free mass, which is a good way to match for cardiorespiratory fitness in males and females, that there was largely no difference in the substrates that we looked at with mitochondrial respiration. Granted, we only really looked at carbohydrate metabolism, so if there's differences in fat metabolism, that's something that can be looked at moving forward, and some other groups have looked at that as well. And then the big project for my PhD is just recently completed. It was part of a larger study by Dani Nyman. She's a PhD student in my lab. She'll be graduating soon as well.
Well, congratulations to both of you. That's exciting, finishing a big project and graduating. So,
Thanks. Yeah, August 2026. But who's counting? And so during that project, it was in collaboration with Dr. David Bardana, looking at the effect of omega-3 fatty acid and essential amino acid supplementation in individuals undergoing ACL reconstruction surgery, so knee surgery. And with that, we were looking at rates of mitochondrial respiration, and we're still doing some data analysis, but sample collection is wrapped up, and looking at mitochondrial respiration, mitochondrial content, looking to collaborate to do some more measures in terms of looking at redox status. So that's still, coming to a theater near you kind of thing. But those are my main PhD projects.
Very cool. So lots of, it sounds like, recovery and understanding how the body changes after periods, different types of stress or disuse or things like that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Okay. And I noticed in your interview form that your title is, or is this your PhD working title, or is this the official one? Mitochondrial responses to skeletal muscle disuse. Is that's the working title, or do you think that'll be the final?
We'll call that the working title.
The working title. Okay. Yes. No, it's hard to say right until the end, but yeah. So what is skeletal muscle disuse then? And can you give us some examples of how skeletal muscle disuse is studied in research? I know you touched on it a little bit, but can you give us a little bit more detail? And what are some of the effects of disuse on skeletal muscle? So what happens when you stop using things?
Yeah, exactly. So with skeletal muscle disuse, it's another way of saying physical inactivity.
Okay.
And so we might experience this in our lives when maybe the flu is going around right now. So anybody who's, at home, staying in bed, trying to rest up for about a week or so, that is like your step reduction model. So you're not getting your, if you're someone who counts your steps on your watch, you're not getting your 10,000 steps in a day. You're getting maybe like 500, a little bit less, a little bit more. And so like step reduction would be one example of skeletal muscle disuse or physical inactivity during our lives. But we might also have experienced periods of muscle disuse where you go through a period of bed rest or hospitalization. So let's say you have an elective surgery, for example, like a hip surgery or a knee surgery, where you have that period of recovery afterwards. And oftentimes it can, depending on your surgery, it can be a week, it can be a little bit longer, where you have those kind of periods of reduced stepping or reduced physical activity, reduced movement. Another example is if you've ever had a cast on, classic example of, signing a cast for somebody when you're in elementary school. But when that cast comes off, usually they're left with an arm or leg that's, a lot skinnier, a lot weaker than the other arm. And that's a really great example or classic example of muscle disuse. And so the way that we study this, so we can do step reduction studies where you take a group of people and you basically have them go through a period of reduced like walking or stepping. So they might go from like their 10,000 steps a day and maybe they go to like 500 and then they can you can study how they recover from that period of step reduction. You can also do single leg immobilization studies, and this is in the context of human. You can also do disuse studies in rodents as well, but specifically for humans, you can do single leg mobilization. So usually we would put like a brace on someone's knee, for example. We've previously performed a study doing that. Kaelin Pufal, our master student who became a PhD student recently, or will become a PhD student, he's about to defend his MSc.
Congratulations to him as well. Lots of lots of people moving up in your lab. That's great to hear.
Yeah. So if you put a brace on someone's knee and maybe they go around on crutches for 2 weeks, so that would be a single leg immobilization study. And in that single leg immobilization model, if you were to do that in a non-surgical population, that would be a simple disuse model. So if I was to leave this room and go put on a brace for 14 days, that would be simple disuse. But if I was someone who's going through a period of surgery, that's a bit more complex because there's a lot of other things going on physiologically in that period of muscle disuse, like inflammation, and there's a whole surgery happening. So it's pretty invasive.
Yeah, that's a lot.
And then another way you can do it in humans is bed rest. So we actually have two bed rest studies going on right now. Those are being led by Tom Tripp and Seb Camargos, postdoctoral fellow in our lab and a master student in our lab. So they've been very busy this fall. But in a bed rest study, you basically have a group of individuals. So again, this would be a simple disuse model where you grab your, you get your participant group and they would go through a period of just staying in a bed all day. So this could be like 5 days. There's some studies that look at really long periods of bed rest. Those are more kind of like space agency studies.
Yes.
And like anti-gravity. Mm-hmm. But for us, we were doing 5 days of bed rest in our lab.
Okay. And that would simulate a recovery from a lot of different types of elective surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Not quite going to the moon and being in anti-gravity. You don't have to study that for a while. And I'm sure that would be incredibly challenging to recruit participants to do bed rest for like 3 or 4 months.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure 5 days is hard enough with participant recruitment.
I imagine with the colder weather, we'll see how it goes. I'm just picturing like curling up with movies and studying for exams, that kind of thing.
That's a pretty great pitch for, so for any of our listeners, if you'd like to participate in a bed rest study, the McGlory Lab has spaces for you this fall. So those are some great examples. So you can do single leg immobilization, or you can stimulate bed rest like your lab is doing right now. And what are skeletal muscle mitochondria, as they are kind of, that's the lead in your title, and why is it so important to study mitochondria in this context?
Yeah, so skeletal muscle mitochondria, you probably know them from high school biology as the powerhouse of the cell.
Yes.
They are essentially, you can think of them as like the downstream kind of power plants of skeletal muscle cells, where mitochondria use the oxygen that we consume and the foods that we eat to produce energy or regenerate energy, if you want to be specific about it, in the form of ATP or adenosine triphosphate. And ATP is required for a lot of processes in our cells, so muscle contraction and muscle protein synthesis. And with disuse too, I didn't mention it earlier, but with muscle disuse, you have those kind of that reduction in muscle mass and strength. And in humans, the reduction in muscle mass, we think, is primarily driven by reductions in muscle protein synthesis. And we are fortunate in our lab that we are able to look at muscle protein synthesis. So we use stable isotope tracer analysis, and that's really been spearheaded by another postdoc in our lab, Dr. John McLeod. But with mitochondria, so for example, if you ate maybe like a bagel for breakfast this morning, that bagel is going to be broken down into carbohydrates. We'll have glucose going through the bloodstream into skeletal muscle. Glucose goes through a process called glycolysis, and then the downstream products of that go to the mitochondria, where we have the electrons donated from the byproducts of that glucose breakdown into the electron transport chain. And then we have the production of ATP. And so it's really important to study mitochondria because it allows us to look at metabolism. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned before talking about different substrates. So for example, like carbohydrate and fats. So we can look at how our mitochondria actually oxidize or use carbohydrate-based substrates to consume oxygen. And then in our experimental assay that we do, we have a couple of assumptions that we keep in mind, but it's usually a proxy of mitochondrial energy production. Mm. And that is currently actually, I think she's in the lab doing it right now, but Dr. Jen Wilkinson, we have 3 postdocs, we're very fortunate, is doing a high-resolution respirometry assay right now to do that. So in our lab, we can actually look at how mitochondria are, oxidizing or using carbohydrates as substrates. And we can also look at fat oxidation, and we can look at a number of different pathways in mitochondria as well using that assay.
So you're able to see a lot from what the mitochondria are doing in response to this muscle disuse that's going on then, it sounds like.
Absolutely, yeah. So trying to interrogate the question of, is it mitochondrial dysfunction with muscle disuse, or is it just a switch in substrate utilization or fuel utilization?
Oh, that makes a lot of sense then. So has a lot of other research been done so far to examine the effects of muscle disuse or longer periods of muscle disuse on skeletal muscle mitochondria to date? And what does that literature look like if it exists?
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, it does exist. In humans, the main kind of models that have been used where mitochondrial respiration or mitochondrial adaptations have been examined is largely single leg immobilization and bed rest studies. With single leg immobilization, and again, this is specific to humans, but it's mostly been simple disuse models. So again, using the knee brace in a healthy population or non-surgical population, and then bed rest studies as well. And what the kind of main findings so far is that mitochondrial respiration and mitochondrial protein content are reduced following a period of single leg immobilization. And in bed rest, it's largely the same, but it depends on the substrate that's been used. Sometimes there is no change. And that's also a product of the sensitivity of the measures that we're using as well.
So your lab is using many different methods, it sounds like, to test these things. And you mentioned that using the different types of substrates. And you're looking at omega-3 fatty acids specifically in this study? Is that and essential amino acids? Do you study other nutrients? And why omega-3 fatty acids and essential amino acids? Is there a reason for this in particular in your study?
Yes. So with essential amino acids, these are basically amino acids that our body can't synthesize. So we have to obtain them from the diet. And essential amino acids are particularly potent stimulators of muscle protein synthesis. Mm. And so then the idea is that with muscle disuse, we have a decrease in muscle mass. But then can we use nutrition, like essential amino acid supplementation, to preserve rates of muscle protein synthesis and therefore, you know, attenuate or blunt the decline in muscle mass that happens with muscle disuse? But what's interesting is that with muscle disuse, our muscle might not respond to essential amino acids like it usually does in kind of this anabolic resistance. But omega-3 fatty acids have previously been shown to basically sensitize skeletal muscle to essential amino acid provision. So our question is really, are omega-3 fatty acids and essential amino acids able to work together to basically attenuate or blunt declines in muscle mass? We're still looking at muscle strength as well. There might be some more that we need to do on the muscle strength side. Previous literature looking at single leg mobilization would suggest that the essential amino acids are able to mitigate declines in muscle protein synthesis and muscle mass, but maybe not so much the muscle strength. So we're still kind of interrogating that question a little bit. And the omega-3 fatty acids is largely based off of Dr. McGlory's previous work during his postdoc, where he actually did a simple disuse model. They looked at young women going through a period of single leg immobilization, so this was 14 days, and what he found was that omega-3 fatty acids largely reduced the decline in muscle mass that happens in this population. And this was also coupled with a mitochondrial respiratory analysis and looking at mitochondrial protein content. And they also found a protective effect of omega-3s on rates of mitochondrial respiration, mitochondrial protein content as well, which is kind of interesting how, you know, sometimes we might think of mitochondria and muscle contraction as kind of these two independent silos. But we're interested in looking at how they might actually be connected a little bit more than maybe what we think of right now. And then in terms of, do we study other nutrients? We do, not in the context of muscle disuse right now, but Noah Gittins and Ray Schnur, also master's students in our lab, are currently looking at the effect of polyphenol supplementation in older adults going through resistance band exercise and also cycling exercise. So that project just started, but I'm really interested to see how that goes, because the polyphenols as an antioxidant might have a link with mitochondria. And Jen Wilkinson is also doing high-resolution respiration analysis on those samples as well.
Wow, so your lab has a lot going on. That's a very exciting time to be a part of all of this great research. And I'm wondering, where do you see your research and maybe your lab's research more generally, where do you see this having an impact?
Yeah, so I think in terms of the impact of the research, if we can reduce the decline in muscle mass and strength following a period of disuse, that is pretty meaningful for a lot of people, not only in the sense of you are probably going to be able to recover faster and maintain function a little bit more and quality of life a little bit more, but the loss of muscle mass and strength is also, you know, kind of a predictor of poor outcomes. So, you know, all-cause mortality. Again, I kind of mentioned like the loss of function, loss of quality of life. So if we can mitigate muscle disuse atrophy, which is kind of this umbrella term for the loss of muscle mass and strength that happens with muscle disuse, then we can have kind of a favorable impact on a lot of people, whether it's, you know, coming out of surgery or if it's going to be, you know, longer periods of disuse that they're going to have to deal with throughout their lives for various reasons. Specifically with the mitochondrial analysis, it's a little bit, you know, less applied maybe. It's more mechanistic, but it's important to understand what's happening to metabolism at the cellular level, especially with muscle cells, because it will help us kind of interrogate whether there's a dysfunction that can mm-hmm. be addressed with different strategies, or whether it's a shift in substrate utilization. So whether your mitochondria are oxidizing more carbohydrates or fats or protein or amino acids, and what that actually means and how we can maybe, you know, use that to, again, impact different stress response pathways or other mechanisms of muscle loss.
This all sounds really exciting and very positive. I know from research to application, it can be a long journey, but the idea that your lab and your project specifically can help people identify, you know, what dietary changes they might need to make or incorporate into their lifestyles before, during, and after a period of muscle disuse. And what comes up anecdotally to mind, of course, is like those surgeries, like you mentioned, like a hip replacement or a knee replacement, or something like bed rest for pregnancy, or some other common periods where people find themselves not using their muscles in the same way they usually do. But to be able to impact those, because those, I mean, those are just some common anecdotes that come to my mind as a non-expert, completely outside of your field right away, that, you know, a lot of people experience in their lifetime some type of period where they aren't using their body in the same way, and this might be able to help them a lot. And I know this is just very, very anecdotal, but a family member is an RPN who works on a recovery floor, and she sees the vast difference people have, you know, when they're able to start using their muscles again after a hip replacement or a knee replacement. She usually works with elderly patients primarily, oh, yeah. and they've usually had a hip replacement, and the difference in quality of life if someone's able to get up and use their muscles sooner, and then someone who, you know, stays immobilized a little bit longer. The difference is incredible. And if, you know, this person could just support their recovery by eating a better diet while they're in hospital, that sounds like a huge potential for improving care, especially as we have an aging population. I think we'll see a lot more people having those types of elective surgeries.
Absolutely.
In the next few decades. So and so it sounds like you have a lot going on right now. You've got a lot in the lab and a lot outside of the lab keeping you very, very busy, but you've also been involved in some other activities on and off campus. And can you tell us a little bit about what you get up to outside of the lab as well?
Absolutely, yeah. So outside of the lab, I am a member of Kingston Gets Active. Mm-hmm. So for those who haven't heard of it, Kingston Gets Active is really a kind of community initiative really led by some individuals out of the SKHS, Dr. Lucy Levesque, and we've got Kristen Cote and Ashley Johnson as our coordinators, and a really cool board this year. Like, everybody's really looking at how we can build our initiatives to increase physical activity participation, reduce barriers to physical activity for all individuals in the KFLNA region. So we have different things that we do throughout the year. There's also a Kingston Gets Active Club on campus. The ambassadors are amazing. And we have Kingston Gets Active Month is now KFLNA Gets Active Month, so in March, when everybody's kind of coming out of our winter hibernation,
yes.
there will be lots of free activities through KFLNA Gets Active Month, and there's also the Active Pass program, and that is celebrating, I believe, its 20th anniversary, so that's pretty exciting.
Cool. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Active Pass?
Yeah, so for grade 5 and grade 9 students, mm-hmm. they get this Active Pass, and it allows them to do physical activity for, like, physical activity programming for free.
Very
so
nice,
it's
yeah.
it's really, I think, an awesome initiative, and mm-hmm. I wish I had it when I was growing up, but happy and really happy that we were able to celebrate that this year. And then I'm also chair now. I was coach chair-elect, but now chair of the Canadian Society for Exercise Physiology student committee. So we'll be doing some initiatives and promotion for, like, Meet My Methods May mm-hmm. and different things to kind of amplify the grad student voice among the CSET membership. And then in terms of what I do for fun.
Where do you have time left over?
Really ring at watching my sister play lacrosse and embroidering, hanging out with dogs. So,
oh, very yeah. nice. Okay, so you have, like, a very, very full and very diverse amount of things going on. I was curious, so how often do you play ring it now that you're in kind of the throes of your PhD as well?
Yeah. So with Ringette, it's a tournament team. So,
oh, very nice.
It's actually run out of Ottawa. We'll have a training weekend mid-November. But it's basically like four tournaments or like four training weekends, and then provincials are actually here this year in Kingston, so there'll be an influx of ringette players around, and anybody who's interested should come watch.
Very cool. When is that taking place? When's provincials?
It'll be, I have to look up the exact date, but it should be like early March. Usually okay. It's February, but early March, so the weather will be a little bit nicer. Mm-hmm. You can, I don't know, the arenas might be a little bit warmer, maybe. But it'll be the AA provincials. So U14 AA, U16 AA, U19 AA, and then I'm on open AA. So it's kind of nice. I get to play with some of the girls that I actually played against growing up. It's a lot nicer when they're not. I'm a goalie, so
Okay.
it's a lot nicer when they're not shooting on you. They're shooting on someone else. But they're an amazing group of women, and I'm very excited to get back on the ice with them.
Oh, that'll be so much fun. And that is really cool to see, because did you play competitively growing up?
I did, yeah.
Yes, okay. So you would remember people from, oh, that person on that team has just got that wicked shot.
Absolutely.
And now she gets to do it on your behalf instead of at you. So what a nice change.
It is really nice. You see them like picking up speed coming down the ice, and it's like, oh yeah, here we go.
And is that comprised of women across the province? Are there any limits, or is it mostly folks from Southern Ontario?
So in this case, the team is based out of Ottawa. Okay. So it's, but we do have people commute from Toronto. Kind of the beauty of Open AA is you play, you don't have to live in the city mm-hmm. where you play. Whereas growing up, it was largely that you had to be kind of in that general area. So I played in Waterloo growing up. But yeah, so you can commute from Ottawa and play for a team in Waterloo. A couple of years I commuted from Kingston to play for Waterloo. So yeah, it's kind of all over the place. Yeah.
Well, that's really great that you're able to keep an activity that you love going throughout your PhD in a way that sounds much more flexible and understands that, you know, everyone who's playing at the open level probably has a lot of other responsibilities going on as well, but still have love for the game and are still able to get together and do that throughout the year via tournaments instead of regular local practices or regular local games. So, oh, that's very nice.
Yeah,
and we'll have to keep an eye out in Kingston for provincials in early March 2026. So,
yeah.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Well, Emily, it has been great chatting with you. Thanks for coming to the show, and good luck with the rest of your research. It sounds like you've got a really supportive and large lab to do to bounce ideas off of people, so I hope it goes very well as you continue on.
Thank you. Yeah, it's Dr. McClory has really created an awesome research team, and they're my best friends, whether they're in or outside of the lab. So, yeah, very fortunate.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. So best of luck on this project, and then all of the other folks that you're supporting as well. Best of luck to everyone in the McGlory Lab. Sounds like a busy fall with all the projects and all the studies that are underway. So best of luck to all of you as those continue.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Anytime. So we'd love to have you back, too, as your PhD progresses, and we'll have to hear some of those results, how they come out on the other end.
Absolutely.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFR Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
From inside a local prison, or do you have a friend or loved one in a local prison or youth detention center? Calls from Home is a monthly radio program for you. On Calls from Home, we share voicemails, messages, song requests, and dedications. Anyone can contact us with a message or song request for a friend or loved one on the inside. To get in touch, call or text 613-917-1390. Email cfrcprisonradio@riseup.net or send us a message on Instagram @cfrcprisonradio. The CFRC radio signal reaches the following local and regional prisons: Millhaven, Bath, Collins Bay and Frontenac, Joyceville and Pittsburgh, the Sundance Youth Detention Center here in Kingston, Quinte in Napanee, and the Cape Vincent Correctional Facility in upstate New York. Messages and song requests will be broadcast once per month on Wednesday between 7 and 8 p.m. here on CFRC 101.9 FM or on the web at cfrc.ca. For 2025, Calls from Home will air on the following dates: April 16th, May 14th, June 11th, July 9th, August 6th, September 3rd, October 1st, October 29th, November 26th, and December 24th. Please send in your message at least one day before the broadcast date. These upcoming show dates, contact info, and additional information is available online at cfrc.ca or on Instagram at CFRC Prison Radio. We look forward to receiving your messages and sharing them over the airwaves.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Today on Wings, some of the highlights of 40,000 years of sacred Venus art with goddess scholar, author, and lecturer, Dr. Anina van der Meer.
Many, many women make little figurines by hand in their own ovens at home, make an offering with such a little figurine in the temple to ask something like fertility, a baby. And when the wish is fulfilled, they offer again a little figurine. That's why we have so many, many, many female figurines. Millions of them all over the world.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Dr. Anina van der Meer is a religious and goddess scholar and director of the Pan Sophia Academy in the Netherlands. Her comprehensive book on sacred female art is The Language of Ma, the Primal Mother, The Evolution of the Female Image in 40,000 Years of Global Venus Art. I'm Mindy Rann. I asked Dr. Anina van der Meer to begin by defining Venus art.
It's sacred feminine art, pre-Christian art, which has as central themes birth, death, and rebirth. We think that these Venus figurines were shamans, were midwives, sages-femmes. They were clan mothers. They were the leaders of the clan, which became very important for later generations because they learned people things, and later generations didn't forget that. And they became icons of clans. And so they had a social function. They had a medical function. They had even a very spiritual function. And the spiritual function had to do with giving birth, helping women giving birth. And when the people died, we think they helped the souls of the people to be birthed in afterlife. So there was a whole cycle of life. And you have the same thing during Ice Age and after Ice Age. But when the ice melts, we see those clan mothers and shamans, female shamans, sitting. They don't stand anymore, but they sit on the earth because they don't need to walk anymore. They have their small gardens or their small agricultural fields. And then we also have the huge group of fully and Rubenesque nanas, we call them now, clan mothers. But we also have the smaller group of skinny and skeleton-like figurines. And when time goes on, these clan mothers are divinized. They become goddesses. And then we have the difference between goddess, priestess, and adorant. And these adorants, so many, many women who make little figurines by hand in their own ovens at home. So they are made millions and millions of them, really, really very, very much. Then they make an offering with such a little figurine in the temple to ask something like fertility, a baby. And when the wish is fulfilled, they offer again a little figurine. You see, that's why you have so many, many, many female figurines. Millions of them all over the world. This is really a global, international art form, feminine art form, which shows the importance of the feminine in ancient societies.
I'm having a problem grasping the concept of how they can represent fertility, which is to me partially sexual, and how that is sexualized in the way that you talk about it. And I think the first one you talk about that this is happening with is the Venus of Holofels.
Well, she was the last Venus found from Ice Age. In 2009, they found lots of parts of her, and then they collected all the parts. It was a Swiss female student who found these parts, and they put the parts together, and there she was. And next to her was a flute, because they played a lot of music and they danced a lot, and they were also in the dark of the cave. So she was found in a cave. But now, and that is the problem of this Venus art, this sacral feminine art, the interpretation of the art. And when the first Venuses were found by the first archaeologist in the 19th century, they saw that they were naked and they had big vulvas. And then they thought, well, this is very unpolite, and they shamed themselves for their nakedness. And they knew the Greek Venuses, who were naked and very erotic. And then they used a name from classical Greek, from a patriarchal feminine image, the eroticized female. They used a name for this very ancient feminine art. So this is called Venus art. And they immediately started to interpret the sacral ancient art as erotic, as pin-up, as a sex symbol, as people in the Ice Age who had all the time sex, because these vulvas and breasts and bellies and buttons were so huge. So they had all kinds of erotic fantasies in this Victorian age. And that's why the erotic interpretation of this sacral feminine art, which has to do with the cycle of life, is till the day of today, and Venus of Holofels is a beautiful example, because she was interpreted by these male archaeologists immediately as a sex symbol. And I had the honor when the professor Nicholas Connaught was in Leiden. He gave a lecture, and so I went to him and I said, well, I admire your work, and she's beautiful, the Venus of Holofels. But why do you call her a sex symbol? He said to me, and I will never forget this, she is a sex symbol. Please take out the newspaper, the daily newspaper, and all the news of the world is turning about sex. And then I was so disappointed by this interpretation that I went home and I thought, well, I've got my school and I'm going to give lectures myself and courses myself, and I will write books about it to change interpretation, because the most used ones are, till the day of today, the erotic ones, because of these vulvas and all these breasts and etc. Or they're normal women who were very fat, who had too much food, who had nothing to do. That is the interpretation of the new archaeology. And they think, well, they are sick, they are pregnant, they are too fat, they are obese, they have a kind of pathology. So what do you think they do to this sacral Venus art? They ruin it. They don't understand a thing.
I can understand the Marilyn Monroe thing, because it's mostly men still who are interpreting this. And I hate to make these sorts of generalizations, but what's going on with the women archaeologists here? Are they buying into that whole Marilyn Monroe, you know, sexy vamp, big breasts, big buttocks, big, you know, big belly, it's a sex symbol thing? Or what's happening to the women's voices here?
Well, I can give the example of Dr. Jill Cook in the British Museum in 2013. There was really an international exhibition, Ice Age Art. And these Venuses from Siberia, from Germany, France, Czechia, most of the most important pieces were there. And Dr. Jill Cook wrote the descriptions next to the Venus figurines, and she also wrote the catalogue. And she left the erotical interpretation, but she chose for the interpretation of pregnancy. All naked Venuses who were fed were pregnant with their first child, with their second child. All fatness was reduced to being pregnant, which is not the case, because some of them are pregnant, but this pregnancy has a symbolic value. It is not about normal women, but it's about a clan mother who is birthing, sometimes with an open vulva, and also the child you nearly see coming out. It's really about birthing life and rebirthing life. So it's also ancestor art. And ancestor art normally has, all over the world, very exaggerated fertility body parts. And this is something of the new archaeology. These are normal women. Fatness is a kind of pregnancy or illness or obesitas. And, well, it is not about the symbolic value. They only look at the outside. It is a kind of materialistic science, materialistic interpretation of art, ancient art. What do the symbols mean? What does a big vulva mean symbolically? Fortunately, the symbolists and also spiritualists, because we also take in the spiritual interpretation of souls being reincarnated again, and that's why its ancestor art is gaining a lot of power, fortunately, because the new archaeology to which Mrs. Jill Cook belongs, they are in the universities, they write the school books, university books, they are in the museum. So you have to have outsiders who have the guts to see it differently. And in my case, I founded a school.
On Wings, you are listening to an interview with Dr. Anina van der Meer, author of the book The Language of Ma, The Primal Mother, The Evolution of Female Image in 40,000 Years of Global Venus Art. The book contains 1,300 illustrations. Dr. van der Meer directs the Pan Sophia Academy in the Netherlands. She was interviewed for Wings by Mindy Ran.
If I'm following you correctly, male archaeologists, historically, particularly from Victorian time, when a lot of these things were being discovered, basically went, ooh, Marilyn Monroe function. The women who have come up afterwards have said pregnancy or normal women.
Yeah.
At least in classic academia. Yeah. Now, it's very clear you disagree with that. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to look at an image that probably almost all of our listeners will have seen referred to. And let's talk about the Venus of Wellendorf.
Yeah.
Now, why don't you describe for our listeners, just in case there is someone out there who hasn't seen it, what the Venus of Wellendorf looks like.
Yeah. So Mrs. Cook called this Venus figurines the woman of Wellendorf. It's a normal woman. So that's a difference. If you come in a museum and you don't know anything about this, you see the woman of Wellendorf, or you see the Venus of Wellendorf, or the Venus figurine of Wellendorf. It makes a difference. It makes a difference. If you read in the description, this is a fat, obese woman who had several children. Or you read in the description, this is the naked body of a figurine from Ice Age from 23,000 BC who wears a round hat on her head with seven layers and a center in the middle, which probably points at her crown chakra. She's very well rooted in the earth because her lower body is very well figured. She has a beautiful belly with a beautiful round navel. She has a beautiful vulva, which is standing a little bit open. She has beautiful breasts, and she's laying her hands on her breasts. And this is a body posture which is very, very important because it shows the breast sustain life. And she has no face. Her little head has no face, no nose, no eyes, no mouth. It could mean that this is not a living clan mother anymore, but she's dead already. Because when you don't have a nose, you can't breathe. You cannot look. So it could be a symbol of a clan mother who passed away, who was very loved, and they would keep her figurine in their hand or in their habitat whenever they needed her. And you can also imagine that when they had difficulties, they would consult her soul by shamanizing her soul. And in that time, they really had contact with the soul world. And we know this from indigenous people who still make this art till the day of today, that the world of the people on earth is linked to the worlds of the souls. They have a multidimensional worldview.
We've come to this place in modern times where there are three very distinct visions of who these Venus represented. And one, as we said, is Marilyn Monroe. One is normal women. And then we get to this shamanistic, sacred Venus art place. It sort of echoes the original feminine tales of girl, mother, grandmother. So we come back to this tale of three seems to be following us.
When you talk about the threeness of the feminine triad, daughter, mother, grandmother, I look at Mary. Mary is threefold. We know the three Marys at the grave, for example. But, you know, this daughter, mother, grandmother thing, which was sacred in ancient societies, which were still harmonious and peaceful and wise, that this threefoldness was divided. So the daughter, the small daughter, she was made in monotheistic religion, especially Christianity, in the traditional Christianity, because the esoterical Christianity sees this different. That's why we found Nakamadi texts and all these kinds of things. But in traditional Christianity, the little girl, the daughter, was made into the mother who stayed the virgin mother. So the mother and the daughter went into one. Very difficult, very complicated construction. But she was the virgin mother and the grandmother. This is the most ugly thing, bizarre thing. The grandmother, who was connected with winter time, autumn, destroying of nature, to clean it up and to prepare it for new life in spring. But the winter goddess, the death goddess, she was put into the world under the earth, which was made into hell. She became the witch. She became very dark and very evil. Because in monotheism, there was only light, which was good, and darkness was bad. And this dark goddess of winter time was demonized. And it's very, very bad, because in this 21st century, when we are heading to a new age, it's very important to see that light and darkness are one, two sides of one metal.
What happened to these ancient images of women? What happened to these Ma images or Venus images during modern civilization, during patriarchy?
Well, when Maria Gimbutas, who is the archaeologist who rediscovered old Europe, and she was professor in UCLA, and she went to five places in Eastern Europe where she digged, where she found Venus art. And then she found 100,000 pieces which were not whole, but she found also 30,000 whole pieces of Venus figurines. And then she went into the museum. These were between the 60s and the 90s. Then she went into the archives of the museum, in the depots, in the cellars, or in wherever they were. And she found so many, many Venus figurines stored away in boxes. In, you know, nobody knew that they were there. Nobody was interested in them. Because everybody thought, well, this is so primitive, this is so handmade, this is Roman. Sometimes they thought it was Roman. It was not Roman 50 BC, it was 5000 BC. So she started to develop the system of symbols about birth, about rebirth, about death and rebirth. She did a fantastic job. Then this Renaissance started with Maria Gimbutas, with Mellart in Anatolia. But while starting and while giving them a symbolic value and a spiritual value, this counter movement of the new archaeology started. Only this materialistic interpretation, only weighing, only measuring, examining every stretch from the outside, making several interpretations, not looking to the anthropologists who did field work in modern indigenous tribes, who discovered that it was still used. These ancestral mothers in Siberia and wherever over the world, especially the clan mothers, were depicted in indigenous tribes. In Russia, you call them matryoshkas. In India, you call them matrikas. Then there became a revival in feminist circles and goddess scholar circles. But they're not, you know, put away in the academic world.
Still,
to the day of today. I want to name Max Dashu, who did a tremendous job of collecting symbols from all over the world. She devoted her life on unknown stories of female leaders, female shamans, and also Venus art. And she also said, like Maria Gimbutas already had stated in the 60s, this is an international art still living till the day of today, which shows the primacy of the female and making society peaceful, harmonious, and loving.
While as late as 2009, anthropologist Paul Mellers suggested that the Venus of Holofels could be seen as bordering on the pornographic. Current entries for the Venus of Willendorf on Wikipedia have already demoted her from goddess to woman. This swing from sex toy to normal woman, with little of the sacred or symbolic in between, appears in the Siberian Times of the 18th of February, 2016.
The headline of the article, Siberia's Venus figurines are not Venuses. And then I found out that these archaeologists was a female archaeologist who was interviewed by the female journalist. And she said, well, they are clothed. We have found many clothings and decorations and hats. And she pointed at the very stick-like figurines who have been found in Malta in Siberia and Buret. So you have the full Rubenesque group, but you also have the stick-like group. And then the stick-like group, she interpreted as being children and teenagers, normal people. So no Venuses, depicted were normal women, normal children, stick-like, and stick-like teenagers. This is an example of the interpretation of the new archaeology. We saw that in London, 2013, Jill Cook, and now these people are in the same direction. They're not talking about Venuses, they are talking about normal clothed women and children and teenagers. But we knew they are not true. Because in Siberia, the very moment Sandra Sakalova is researching in the Arctic area, and there, these stick-like, very thin images with a round head, they are the ancestor symbols. And in the cat, they're especially the ancestor mothers who are kept with the fire, close to the hearth, where all the peoples gather, where they cook, where they talk, where they are warm together. So these are ancestral figurines who guard and protect the living ones. And especially the Sandra Sakaleva, she found out, especially the mother of the tent is communicating with the ancestral spirits. When there is no mother of the house, the ancestral spirits are being put away and the tent is, you know, is gone because there's no family anymore. So with this anthropologist's foundings, these archaeologists don't mind about this anthropological fieldwork. We are pleading for an interdisciplinary attitude. You see, anthropology, archaeology, psychology, art history, all those fields, you have to put the research together and then you have to develop a view on the art. So I think these Siberian archaeologists miss the point.
Dr. Anina van der Meer is a religious and goddess scholar and director of the Pan Sophia Academy in the Netherlands. Her comprehensive book on sacred female art is The Language of Ma, the Primal Mother, the Evolution of the Female Image in 40,000 Years of Global Venus Art. I'm Mindy Rann in Amsterdam for Wings.
Dr. Anina van der Meer's book is published in Canada by Demeter Press. Her newest book in English, Magdalene's Ascension, was published by Simon & Schuster Canada in 2025. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be found at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's maternalgifteconomymovement, all one word,
www.thewingsound.org. The Wing Sound logo is from Lee Bana's album, A Circle Is Cast. I'm Wing Series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st. Help us raise $25,000 to support our local arts and artists and keep our community informed with local news, concerts, and event listings on air and on our website. Visit CFRC.ca today and make your gift to Kingston's longest-running broadcaster serving our community since 1922. Get a tax receipt via Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. For every $5 donated, you get one more chance to win.